Hey there, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the BHB Perspectives Podcast. I'm Chris Larson, Senior Reporter for Behavioral Health Business. For this episode, I caught up with Discovery Behavioral Health CEO and President John Pelequin. Discovery Behavioral Health offers addiction treatment, mental health, and eating disorder treatment to adults and pediatric patients across a total of 130 residential and outpatient treatment programs. Pelequin joined one of Discovery Behavioral Health's progenitor organizations, Cliffside Malibu, in 2017. The following year, Cliffside Malibu and a company called the Center of Discovery merged to create the company we know today. In this chat, Pelequin and I talk about what has not changed in an ever-evolving behavioral health industry, measuring care outcomes at scale, looming changes to Medicaid, and his latest aha moment as a leader in the behavioral health space. If you're interested in joining BHB for a conversation on the BHB Perspectives podcast or during any of our increasing slate of digital or in-person events, reach out anytime. Okay, let's get into it. Hey there, John. How's it going?
Very well, Chris. How are you doing today?
Oh, doing great. Thanks so much for joining us. So I wanted to start off by getting to know Discovery Behavioral Health a little bit better. So at the broadest level, what are the organization's service lines?
So we provide four service lines. We provide behavioral health treatment to eating disorders, mental health, substance abuse, and psychiatric care. Those are the four verticals that we offer. We treat adolescents as well as adults. And within there, we try to foster a, you know, just a supportive environment that will empower people to achieve recovery. And, our mantra is to, everybody deserves a happy and rewarding life. One of the things, Chris, that's important to note on what we do differently is we take a broader look at treatment on all of our service capabilities. We have a tool called D365. It's an AI-driven tool that is delivered post-treatment of care. So what that means is when somebody comes into treatment for the first 30, 60, 90 days, what we do is we link that person up with this tool that allows them to be tracked and monitored over the next 12 months. So what we're trying to accomplish is to be able to look more longitudinal with our care delivery.
I gotcha. So let's stay with getting to know the company just a little bit better and learn a little bit more about the scale of the company. So how many sites of service does Discovery operate and in how many states, for example?
So we're roughly 11 states, 130 locations right now.
Awesome. So, John, when we've talked about this in the past, the whole of behavioral health is shifting. It's been in flux for the last few years, especially since the onset of COVID. How has Discovery Behavioral Health shifted its strategy to account for the shifting environment?
You know, we haven't shifted a bit, Chris. We've remained on the same path. Main focus on, three primary principles, right? Providing quality care in a very efficient way and get the greatest results we can for each patient that comes through our admissions doors.
So in trying to accomplish that, nothing's had to change in the last 5 years or so?
No, I mean, we've just been growing through patient quality. We've had to, over the last several years with this flux period that you mentioned, you see payer dynamic shifting. You're seeing a bunch of different things externally, but our core business path has stayed the same.
I got you. So let's talk about care quality. So specifically, I want to talk about a large study that Discovery did with Brigham and Women's Hospital. So it assesses recovery assessment scale scores and how they evolve over the course of treatment. And this was to get a deeper understanding of patient recovery trajectories. So there are several findings, but the one that I want to highlight is the change in these RAS scores at discharge. Those with the lowest RAS scores or the lowest personal assessment of their own recovery at admission made the biggest improvements, but those scores didn't quite reach the RAS score levels of other higher score at admission cohorts.
Yeah.
So why was that?
Well, let's take a step back as to what we're trying to accomplish. So the recovery assessment tool measures quality of life, functioning, social support. A lot of people will describe that as readiness for treatment. Are they prepared? Are they ready to get into treatment? We know therapeutic alliance will engage that individual and be able to take these core features to engaging that patient to be successful. So why we do the recovery assessment scale, it's a broad metric that covers many domains, and it's helpful to track the patient progress over time that allows us to match our interventions according to that patient's need. So getting a snapshot in the front end of what a patient access provides a nice foundation and insight to where that patient is. So when you look at through the RAS scores, it doesn't surprise me that a patient with a lower score is more engaging in treatment, right? They feel like they need more treatment. So with that, what people will come into is that they'll be more engaging into treatment. You have to also couple the RAS scores with your other scores, PHQ-9, GAD-7, to triangulate where that patient is in their treatment journey and to be able to triangulate that with the right interventions accordingly. So that gives you a more holistic perspective to understand the comprehensive nature of the recovery. So it wouldn't surprise me, and it's very natural for somebody who would find themselves scoring lower to have more engagement in treatment and have a much greater progress towards the endpoint. You see that in so many different ways. One of the scores that we were able to achieve out of this, it didn't get part of the publish, is I'll give a great example of confidence, patients' confidence. What we were able to detect in the study is that a patient that had eating disorder, mental health, had more confidence of re-engaging outside of treatment than the addiction properties. So what that meant was that the SUD side of the house had a shorter length of stay. So there is more time, and it supports a longitudinal process and approach of treatment versus just a 20-day episode of care. So there were some other feature sets there that really was illuminated with this study.
Understood. So we did just talk about some additional insights from the study itself, but was there anything else that you would highlight as potentially insightful about the results of this work?
Our system of care is working highly effective, promoting patient recovery, demonstrates that our evidence-based approach are beneficial and impactful to all of our patients that come through our system of care.
Okay, so shifting gears a little bit, I still want to keep talking about the study, but I do want to get a little meta and talk about how this was possible. So in the study text, it talks about pulling data from the Discovery EHR, and electronic health records aren't exactly the norm, as important as they are within behavioral health, especially in comparison to the physical healthcare industry. So I take it to mean that, this wouldn't have been possible without the EHR, or in other words, having an electronic health record enable Discovery to do the study. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. So what else does an EHR enable your organization to do that otherwise it would not be able to do?
Yeah, one of the things that you got to step back is, the mission of Discovery was to grow multi-locations. So the first question is how do you make sure you have a standard of care across all of those programs? Paper charting will just not get you there. There's fraught with just local, therapists just doing their own thing. So we needed to come up with a system, and we've woven all of these features into our EHR. So what we were able to do is bring in all of our, RAS scores, PHQ-9, GAD-7s, in the right time and in right breakpoints to certain events in the treatment continuum, so we can measure and calibrate the treatment offerings in there. So all of our tools are built directly into the EHR, so we have conformity across all of our systems. What we call ourselves internally, Chris, is a learning health system. We try to measure every point of care across that patient, not to homogenize treatment, but to try to calibrate and give that patient what they need to get them well.
I gotcha. So let's go ahead and shift gears away from the study and things connected to that. I want to talk about another major news announcement that we got from Discovery just a little while back. So late last year, Discovery announced that it had secured an agreement with Optum for Houston-based Discovery Behavioral Health Entity Prevention and Recovery Center to see Opta Medicaid patients in Houston and the surrounding areas in Harris County. So why was this a meaningful development for the company?
Always part of our continuum. We've already done Medicaid in other parts of the country on some of our services. And it's very natural for us to get more Medicaid patients. One of the things that we measure is who calls us and what's their funding sources and what have you. We had an overwhelming majority specific to Houston to Medicaid population. So it was very natural for us to be able to offer that to that population.
I gotcha. So help us put this into kind of a bigger context. At the end of last year, let's say, what percentage of the overall company revenue came from treating Medicaid patients? And how do you expect that to change, if at all, in the future? You mentioned that it is natural.
Yeah, we're probably, I don't know the specific number, but we're probably less than 10% of our population was Medicaid, Chris, the rest being commercial. We will naturally, I don't have a set amount of, bringing, 20, 30, 40% of Medicaid. It would be very strategic for the company where it makes sense to, as I've always said, we want to enter into a community, and become a fabric of that community. And doesn't matter to me what type of funding source that looks like.
I hear you loud and clear. So doing this naturally and following the needs of the community, definitely a very important and useful strategy across the board. But when we zoom out a little bit and try to look at the wider world, we see the potential for Medicaid cuts coming out of DC. So does the potential for cuts to Medicaid challenge this kind of work in the future?
It would definitely put a pause into thinking, on a go forward. I've been around for over 20 years. I've lived through Medicaid rollbacks and deferment payments and what have you. Not an experience that I enjoyed. So it would be definitely part of the calculus. All of the things happening in DC and changing Medicaid, Medicare is still, fluid. So I'm not entirely sure I've seen anything that would change that would be Medicaid rates would roll back or whatever. But it is definitely part of the calculus.
Yeah, hear you loud and clear. And we're still waiting to see how that shakes out. I don't know if there'll be a major development by the time this podcast comes out, but dear listener, do realize it's a very dynamic situation. We might not be the most up-to-date at the time of recording, but we're doing the best with what we got right now. Okay, I wanted to take you to another topic still related to the wider world of payer dynamics. And I want to talk about value-based care. It's on my mind. Just got done with Value 2025, where I talked about this nonstop for the better part of 3 days. So I wanted to see where Discovery is at when it comes to engaging with value-based care. Is this a priority for you as a CEO of this company?
No. I'll tell you the reason why.
Tell me why.
I've been hearing about value-based care for 10 plus years. Several years ago, I engaged all of the payers that are part of our continuum of, I've opened my organization to the payers saying, I can prove value statistically. Part of the study that you mentioned earlier gives me evidence that I can not only just say that I'm a good provider, I can demonstrate statistically the clinical outcomes of all patients that come in through our treatment continuum. So I took that knowledge and I brought it to all of the payers, and none of them were ready. I mean, I shouldn't say none of them. There's a handful that are trying to dabble into a value-based framework, but none of the payers are really at a place where they're ready to do a value-based relationship.
I gotcha. No, I do want to follow up on that a little bit. Part of the vibe at Value 2025 was near equal parts hope and frustration. A big part of it was due to a lack of progress on the part of the development of these kind of arrangements, even when people make the investments to prove statistically that they're doing a good job taking care of high need, high deserving patients. So what kind of conversations were enabled or happened in the place of a value-based care conversation over at Discovery?
Well, there's a, when you take a look at the payer looks through a lens of total cost of care. right? That's where they measure behavioral health. And so within that construct, what can the providers do that'll provide an efficient value model that gets the payers where they need to be from a total cost of care? You know, at the end of the day, behavioral is a very, you know, small fraction of what their spend is, but they all have an acute awareness that it's the tip of the spear on emergency visits in a higher cost. So I think that relative to a value-based, it shouldn't be that is all or nothing. There's a lot of different types of relationships you can get into that are not, you know, you can get into case rate relationships. You don't have to go to a fee for service model that would be able to be mutually beneficial for the payers. And that's really at the heart of it is I believe that the field has not done an adequate job of demonstrating value and can prove it statistically. I believe that's a differentiator for my company where I have a relationship with Brigham Women's Harvard to be able to demonstrate that. I have a third party validation. I take that to the payers. That doesn't get me over the finish line because they don't understand behavioral as well. Doesn't suggest that we should stop talking about value-based. It doesn't suggest that there's just no opportunity here. It's really going to be on the payers to make sure that they have a desire to address behavioral health in a more systemic way.
I gotcha. So bearing that in mind with having payers needing to consider behavioral health in a more systemic way, should the industry keep focusing on value-based care? And the reason that I keep talking about it, the reason that we keep hosting an event that's totally dedicated to it, it's because we emulate to some degree what we talked about earlier by going to the community and trying to reflect or address its needs. People keep telling us this is a big deal. So understanding where you're coming from, what do you think the wider industry needs to do in terms of discourse around payment and payment innovation?
Well, I think the first step is, you know, the field itself should take, you know, and it's a broad brush here, but we all need to do better. My organization needs to do better of getting that value proposition. The payers need to come forward in a meaningful way to be able to come up with reimbursement models that fits their construct of total patient care to be able to thread how behavioral considers that. Now, one of the things that is I feel is broken in the system is when you look at the way carriers now, they only look at a book of business for a year or two. So their motivation is for deferment. So that's probably a more, that's another webcast conversation, but that's the greatest challenge that it'll be a headwind to really put anything meaningful for a savings program with a behavioral health provider. So I think that getting to a value-based case rate, whatever the vehicle is, it's more of the partnership in aligning what the carrier goals are and how does that provider fit within there. So I would foster more conversation and dialogue with the payers. They're not the enemy. They're part of the stakeholder process. So need to have more relationships, move away from an us versus them and become a more holistic type of approach.
Yeah, I hear you. Increasingly holistic approaches is a pretty defining characteristic of the last 2 years, at least of my coverage. It'll be interesting to see how that shakes out in terms of payment and payment innovation. So let's actually keep on that theme. Let's cast our minds to the future a bit. So what is the top goal that Discovery will hopefully accomplish by the end of this year?
Same things. You know, for us is we are heads down on providing the quality care for every patient that comes in. We're trying to do that in the most cost-effective, most efficient way possible and driving the greatest results. For me, there's a lot of noise outside the walls of this company. You got a lot of political, you got a whole bunch of different things. Let's control what we can control, which is delivering the best care that we possibly can to each patient that comes through our office. And I think the chips will fall where they may.
So shifting from our thinking of the future, I actually want to talk a little bit about the recent past. What is your latest aha moment in your study and your work within the behavioral health industry? Or in other words, what's a recent learning that you have personally found impactful about the behavioral health industry?
Relative to the studies that we've done and the collection of work that Discovery has done, it is very humbling for me that it's proving that behavioral health, specifically our care model, is validated as a validated treatment model for a patient to come in through our system. We're trying to lead by example, not just simply by we're great, we're better, we're that. That's not what it's all about. It's really trying to create a roadmap of bringing value to behavioral health and this company on that we can prove the quality that we're administering. We want to make sure that we're just not saying that we're good, and that we can prove that we have a quality system of care. That's not something many providers like us can say, that's out there. And I welcome others to take a simple, a page off of this organization on how we try to deliver care in a learning health-centered approach, trying to make sure that we use data not to homogenize, not to strip costs, but we're trying to use data because we believe that the data surrounding a patient will be able to adjust our treatment interventions for a much greater result for the patient. And isn't that what we're trying to do, collectively?
John Pelequin, CEO of Discovery Behavioral Health. Thanks a ton for being here.
Thank you, Chris.
Thanks for joining us on another episode of the BHB Perspectives podcast. I'm Chris Larson, Senior Reporter for Behavioral Health Business, a WTWH media company. We'll catch you next time.